Pod.
Hello and welcome back to BNSSG Peds Pod, where we'll be talking about health inequalities in children and young people. I'm Ruth Bowen, I'm a Bristol GP, bringing child and young person education to primary care clinicians. Today we're at the South Gloucestershire Civic Offices, where I'm meeting Helen Tapson, Public Health Consultant and Lead for Child and Young Person Health Inequalities. Hi Helen.
Hi Ruth.
Welcome, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So we're going to think about the broad context of health inequalities in children and young people and then zoom in to proactively what can we be doing in primary care. Could you tell us a little bit more about the South Gloucestershire Direction of Public Health report that's recently been published looking at health inequalities in children and young people? What does it tell us?
Could I start by thanking a few people for all the work that went into this report? So in particular, Paul Okadeji, who's one of our registrars, who did loads of work on this report. And to everyone else who inputted their time and expertise, it was a big piece of work to get done. This report is about South Gloss specifically, but the themes will be true across the country and across BNSSG. Forgive me if I'm a bit South Gloss-centric, but the learning from it is relevant to all of us.
Absolutely.
You may or may not know, directors of public health have a statutory responsibility to produce a report each year, looking at the health of their population. This year, Sarah, our director, chose to focus on children's health inequalities in particular. And this felt really important to us for a couple of reasons. South Gloucestershire is quite an affluent area. So if we look at overall outcomes for children, we tend to perform similarly or better to national. But actually, what this hides is real inequalities. Some groups of our population aren't having those good outcomes, and that's what we wanted to look at in more detail. In addition, whilst we know that children weren't really affected as much as adults from a health and disease perspective by COVID, they were hugely impacted by the control measures that were put in place. We also know that the effects of this are still emerging, but that they were felt most acutely by those that already had the least. It's that phrase, we were all in the same storm, but we were not all in the same boat. This again was something we wanted to dig a bit deeper into. Before I go into detail of what the report found, it's possibly worth exploring briefly what we mean when we say inequalities. What we mean is unfair and avoidable differences in health or any other outcomes across population and between different groups within society. So they can be looked at in a number of different ways. We're probably more familiar with looking at socioeconomic disadvantage, things like education, low income, housing, unemployment as a really key driver of inequalities. The circumstances in which people live and grow have a huge impact on their health, none more than children. We know that children from less affluent backgrounds are more likely to be worse off than their counterparts from more affluent settings. But what's particularly interesting here is there's some evidence to show that children from deprived backgrounds living in affluent areas can actually have worse outcomes than children from deprived backgrounds who live in deprived areas. That's really relevant to us in South Gloucestershire in particular.
How interesting.
Yeah, I know. It's not necessarily what you'd think, and I think the reasons for that are probably pretty complex, but it is an interesting finding. While socioeconomic disadvantage is a key driver of inequalities, we also know there's other factors that can impact on outcomes for children. So things like protected characteristics, and by that we mean ethnicity, gender, sexuality, religion. They're often associated with inequality as well. The relationship here is quite nuanced and complex, but we do know that discrimination, stigma and trauma all affect people's outcomes. For example, according to the latest National Embrace report, black women were almost four times more likely to die than white women giving birth. It's a really stark and shocking statistic.
Mm.
In addition, there's other particular groups we know that are vulnerable to poor outcomes, Gypsy and Roman travellers, children with special educational needs and children of offenders as just an example of some of those other groups we know that might need a bit more support and help. To add to all this, we know that these factors that are associated with inequalities don't occur in isolation. In fact, they're actually really likely to cluster in individuals, families and communities. We did a recent children and young people's needs assessment looking at the health and wellbeing across the population of children and young people. And it's the evidence base we built on to do this Director of Public Health report. That found really significant crossover and intersectionality between these vulnerable groups. So, for example, it reported that half of the children who met the criteria to be considered in need, which is in receipt of social care services, are also eligible for free school meals. Nearly a third have an educational health and care plan, so special educational needs. And indeed, a quarter require special educational needs support. So if we know that outcomes are worse for children with each of these individual vulnerabilities, we can only imagine what the impact is for children that have those layered on top of each other. It's something we need to get better understanding because we don't really understand that so well yet.
Understanding how they interact together and
exactly
what the impact of that is.
Yeah. And the best ways, therefore, to support families and children with those multiple layers of disadvantage.
Absolutely. And in reports like that, we often hear the phrase the inverse care law. What does that mean?
The inverse care law is something that was first proposed in the 70s, but we definitely still see it in effect today. It's the observation that disadvantaged populations generally need more healthcare than advantaged populations, but receive less. And things like universal healthcare that's free at the point of use can help with that. Mm-hmm. So we see less inverse care law where we've got that available, but it's not enough on its own to eliminate it. There's things we can do to reduce the impacts. So thinking really carefully when we're planning services about the location and the accessibility of those, making sure they're accessible to people that, say, might not have their own forms of transport. Not always expecting people to come to us, but reaching out to people who we know might have poorer outcomes. Outreach is really important, especially when we think about preventative healthcare. When people are really sick, they will tend to come to us, but so often it's too late to make good difference by that point. So reaching out with those earlier interventions is really important. Maximising opportunities when we do make contact with people to explore their health and wellbeing more holistically. So if someone's coming to see a GP, for example, with a specific health concern, using that opportunity to explore their health in a holistic way. And finally, working with communities directly to understand what works for them and what matters to them, I think really can help with this. So there was some great work done in BNSSG around the COVID vaccinations, working directly with communities to understand what their concerns were and help work with them, really increasing rates of vaccination in more vulnerable populations by doing that. Thinking about the inverse care law from that perspective can be really helpful.
So that's a really good example of a project going on locally that's been successful in this area. Are there any other projects or schemes currently going on in the BNSSG area?
There's so much going on, and when we think about children's health inequalities, we shouldn't forget our universal services, which are absolutely important here. So our maternity services, health visiting GPs, as an example of consistently providing that input to children and families and reducing inequalities. In addition to that, this won't cover everything. We do some work with maternal smoking cessation. We know that's a real risk factor for poor outcomes for mothers and babies, working with maternity services closely to help support mothers to quit smoking while they're pregnant and support them to stay smoke-free and have a smoke-free home after giving birth. We've got something called MESH, which is support provided through health visitors to families with specific vulnerabilities. So it's a bit more intensive support to help them support their baby's growth and development and their own health and wellbeing at that time that we all know can be a really stressful time for new parents. So that's a brilliant, very evidence-based support scheme that came from Australia.
Is that targeted at anyone in particular?
The good thing about it actually is it's targeted to a really wide range of vulnerabilities. There's been things before that people might know about, like the Family Nurse Partnership, which was also a really good scheme, but was very specifically based on age of mother. This is much broader than that. Age of mother would be a risk factor. So if you're a very young mum, you might need some extra support, and that can be provided through this. But it can also be other vulnerabilities, say mental health needs, physical disability. The range is quite broad, and I think that's one of the assets of that scheme. We provide breastfeeding support. Health visitors do that anyway, but there's extra support in the community for people that are struggling. Breastfeeding is really important for the health of a baby in the early weeks and months of its life. We've got injury prevention equipment available, again, through health visitors. If families are struggling to afford things like cupboard locks, they can have someone come round and fit them, keep babies and children safe.
Fantastic.
We've got a package of support around financial insecurity, because we know that's really fundamental to children's inequalities. Through our one-stop shops, people can get advice on the benefits they're entitled to, ways to maximise their income, lots going on there that hopefully people can be linked into.
Is that specific to South Gloucestershire?
We have our own support in South Gloucestershire, but other areas do have it. It's got slightly different names and things in different areas, and that's the trick. I can provide a list of resources at the end of this, and I'll try and include the resources for Bristol and North Somerset as well. Another thing we've got that's quite new that I'm really excited about is family link workers. So this is around children's attendance at school. So it's something that we've been increasingly, I guess, concerned about since COVID. Rates of persistent absenteeism have really gone up across the whole country. We've got a programme of support around schools, which family link workers are at the centre of, to support families with whatever it is that's a barrier to their child attending school regularly.
That actually links in really well with a podcast that was just released a couple of months ago on school non-attendance. That'd be really interesting looking into that.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So some really good projects going on at the moment. Can you tell us anything more about the first 1001 days work? What is the first 1001 days and why is it important?
Yeah, so the first 1001 days of a child's life, and by this we mean conception until age two. So it's really emphasising the importance that it's literally from that moment of conception that we can actually make a difference for families. It's really well recognised. There's a really well-established and growing body of evidence that this is a critical time for a child's development. And that in a way, things that don't work out in this time might be fundamentally lost, if that makes sense, in terms of the ability of a child to develop well. It's a national piece of research that did this with a vision and some guidance of what we should be producing locally to support it. It's also recognised that during this first 1001 days is a time that families actually probably need more support. It's quite a big change for a family's life to have a child, and they might not know exactly the right way to be doing things, or they might need extra support. We know there's loads of really great support out there already, but we do find sometimes the feedback from families is this can be a bit disjointed and inaccessible. At the core of this first 1001 days work is thinking about how we can make sure that this great support we're offering is better joined up and more accessible and to the families that need it. It's thinking about the health-based services, so maternity services, GPs and health visitors at the core. It's thinking about mental health alongside that as well, really important for children and families. And then layering on top of that, can we bring in things like debt advice and more holistic support and housing advice, preferably in one place with probably a digital and online offer as well, to make it accessible to as big a range of families as we possibly can.
A pretty huge project, really, that will be absolutely fantastic once that's completed.
Yes, hopefully. It's difficult because some areas received national funding to do this, so Bristol was one of those. Other areas haven't. South Gloucester and North Somerset are those areas. So it's about thinking how we work within the resources we've got to try and achieve it. It's going to require some really great partnership working to develop that service locally.
Well, that's one definitely for us to look out for once that report gets released.
Yeah.
You've given a few examples of the types of factors that can lead to health inequalities in children and young people. Can you give us any other ideas of what's leading to this inequality? It's quite a complex area, really, isn't it?
It is quite a complex area. We know that inequalities occur across the life course. So starting, as we've said, at conception, mothers from deprived backgrounds are 3 times more likely to smoke during pregnancy, as an example, leading to poorer birth outcomes, low birth weight, stillbirths. They're less likely to start and continue breastfeeding. So what you're getting is that someone's life circumstances that make their lives a bit more difficult, that might make them less able to feel that they can access services, they might have less support around them and less resources to mitigate the stresses of life. Something's difficult. Having resources such as financial resources or support around you can help make those things easier. If you don't have those things, you're more at risk when things go a bit wrong, of experiencing the ill effects of those. And then they can layer on top of each other. And so we see these impacts during a pregnancy, and then the children go to school, and we know that children who are eligible for free school meals, so that's a means-tested benefit, so we use it as a bit of a proxy for financial insecurity. They tend to have worse developmental outcomes, so the proportion of children achieving a good level of development by the end of reception is almost 30% lower among those eligible for free school meals when compared to children of the same age. And this gap's widening. And so that's really right at the beginning of education, before they've even gone through the education system. They've already got this 30% gap. And then during the years they're in school, we see this widening. And again, it's those same factors coming back, having the financial insecurity, not having the resources you need. Often intergenerational trauma as well, really impacting on families' mental health across the generations. Good school attendance and good educational attainment are just huge protective factors for a child's whole life. So again, if they're not attending school, that's a risk both for their attainment in school, but also for their health and well-being. And then not achieving from an attainment perspective, then knocks on to that next generation, because their ability then to secure employment and be financially secure is reduced. And so it knocks on to their next generation, their own children's lives.
It's very much cyclical. Gosh, that 30%, that's quite phenomenal at that young age.
Yeah,
knowing really that gap is just going to widen and widen as they get older.
I know, it really is. It's one of the things we work on to try and reduce that as much as we possibly can.
Now that we've thought a little bit about the broad context of health inequalities in children and young people, we now zoom in a bit and think about some cases just to practically give some tips of what can we be doing in primary care. So the first case, mum presents with 6-year-old Sunil with his asthma. He's on Clenil and Salbutamol and has been using his Salbutamol 4 times weekly over winter. Dad smokes outside of the house, they live on a busy urban road, and mum is concerned about mould levels in her rented house. Is there anything else that you'd want to know about Sunil and his family?
There's lots of ways a GP could help here. They have a really important role as a trusted point of contact for the family, and they have an ability to inquire about the whole family situation a bit more broadly. So I'd really encourage them to do that. They might want to inquire about the family's mental health as well at this point. That sounds quite a stressful situation. to ask about how mum's feeling and how other family members might be feeling. Are there younger siblings involved here as well and what their health and well-being is like? Then you can think about the services that might be relevant for a younger child, for example. You might want to make sure they're linked into their health visitor and things like that to support. One of the things we're trying to encourage people to do locally is to think family. Even though the focus here is on the child's asthma, we know that children's well-being is so influenced by the well-being of their parents and the family they live in. Thinking in a really holistic way here is quite important. Going on to think about the mould in the house, it makes me wonder if the family could afford to heat their home sufficiently. You might want to think about putting them in touch with some financial support. I'd recommend that in South Gloss they contacted their local one-stop shop. In Bristol, this is called a citizen service point. In North Somerset, it can be done through libraries. I can provide links. Our one-stop shop can provide free, professional, confidential advice and information on topics from welfare, benefits, debt, housing and employment. Another good option here is Citizens Advice. They're available in lots of different areas. They can also support with this kind of thing. And so just to check that they've got the income they need to make sure their house is warm, which obviously can help with mould. There's also a cost of living page on the South Gloss Council website. Bristol and North Somerset have something similar as well. Lots of information and links for families to put them in touch with ways to maximise their financial security.
Are there any other opportunities here for the primary care clinician to support or signpost the family to outside of the finances?
I'd really like to put the father in contact with Stop Smoking Services.
Yeah.
He's doing the right thing smoking outside, but there'll still be some exposure to secondhand smoke this way. And we also know that children will be more likely to become smokers themselves if they see him smoking. So the best thing of all is not to smoke. Plus, of course, smoking is quite expensive, so it can save this family money if he stopped. There's a free NHS app, and also there's support across BNSSG, including access to free vapes, which have shown to be the most effective tool to help people quit. In South Gloss, we have something called the One You service, and that can offer help, both in terms of giving them access to those quitting tools like vapes, but also the behavioural support.
Brilliant, thank you. Moving on to our second case, 18-year-old Aisha brings in her son Rashid for his 8-week check. Aisha's been in the UK for 6 months and is temporarily staying with some family contacts. She's in the process of seeking leave to remain after fleeing Afghanistan. The GP has a telephone translator on speaker. There's obviously a wealth of value a good GP can provide here. Can you talk us through any crucial opportunities to support Aisha and Rashid that you wouldn't want the GP to miss?
Yeah, some standard things, as you said, that a GP would cover in this situation for anyone, and then there'll be some things that are particularly relevant to the situation. I think it's really important to think about cultural sensitivity here and to, on a practice level, think about if this is understood in terms of the communities that make up your practice population, making sure you understand who your population is, any cultural sensitivities that there might be, and to check what specific risks and needs might be associated with this, maybe practice-wide training if appropriate. Serona wellbeing leads work across localities and can actually help with this if needed. It's worth noting here as well that it's a little bit complex about what might qualify someone as a refugee or asylum seeker. So staying with family doesn't necessarily qualify someone as a refugee or asylum seeker. If they are a refugee or asylum seeker, they should be connected with support via Haven. So a GP could check they were linked into that if it was relevant. So in terms of things to cover, I don't want to preach to GPs, I'm sure they would do this. You'd cover vaccinations, safe sleeping, breastfeeding support, ICON, which is about dealing with babies crying. You'd want to check they were in contact with important people like their health visitor in this situation, particularly if someone maybe wasn't so familiar with the UK health system.
Yeah, from my experience of people who've recently moved to the UK, there's often a bit of confusion over how the health system works. And so they can often present to A&E a lot, don't understand about health visitors, when to come to general practice, where that support is for them. So I definitely wouldn't assume that people know how the health system works and how to get the support they need when they need it.
Yeah. You'd probably want to talk about ongoing contraception. You want to inquire into the presence or absence of a father or a male caregiver. Who are the key people in the family life? Even if the father isn't present, it's really important to ask about them still. Also check in for any concerns about domestic violence as well. You might want to talk about wider finance and housing support. There's lots of things they might want to be accessing as a family, so things like Healthy Start vouchers to get fruit and vegetables for the family. Again, linking them in with the one-stop shop might be a good idea. Think about the healthcare system more broadly, as I said, so health visitors as an example, dentists, making sure they are linked into everyone that might be able to support them. Also, really thinking about things like trauma and mental health here. Potentially, if someone's come to the country from another country, there really might be some significant trauma they've encountered, but also mental health and postnatal depression really relevant for any new mum as well. In a recent piece of research, they found that women who died from suicide postpartum, they noticed that stigma around mental health might be much more prevalent in some cultures compared to others, and really had influenced the willingness of the women or their families to be open about their concerns. And so I think in this kind of case in particular, really thinking about the language we use and how we talk about mental health can be really important.
Really normalising it.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe not even using the word mental health, because that can have connotations for people in some cultures. Perhaps talking about just feeling very sad, the features of depression, rather than labelling it as a mental health issue, which for some people is fine, but not for everyone.
And she's obviously going to be a very high risk with potential history of trauma, and she's only 18.
Yeah.
She's probably not got much of a support system here, so she is really vulnerable even before you then enter that cultural difference of
Absolutely.
The stigma around it.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So that's two examples of areas that as primary care clinicians we might be able to think a bit more detail about health inequalities in children and young people and how we can have influence. Are there any other specific patient contacts where you think reducing health inequalities should be a real focus?
From a general perspective, I think part of the opportunity here is understanding people and their life circumstances in a holistic way. Things like leading with quite open questions, things like, what are you worried about? Rather than necessarily drilling straight down into a specific health condition, giving people the opportunity to tell you what it is they're worried about and looking beyond the specific health condition to the things that might underlie it.
Absolutely, and that's very much drilled into us as primary care clinicians from the start, always asking, you know, what are their ideas, concerns, expectations? But absolutely, that can reveal some quite interesting hidden agendas, which I guess can unravel some of those social situations and give us a bit more holistic approach.
We're saying this as if it's easy, but I appreciate it's a really time-limited appointment and it must be difficult and have what can be, I think, quite difficult and sensitive conversations.
Yeah. And I was having a little bit of a think about what particular areas should we have at the forefront of our mind, and thinking obesity in childhood, neurodiversity, challenging behaviours, drug and alcohol misuse and mental health, both in the children and in the adults. Obviously, if there's any domestic violence, we need to know, are there children in the house? Contraception, again, is a really good area to be exploring. Are there any other areas that you think we should have it more at the forefront of our mind? This needs to be something that we work into every aspect of life and every consultation. But there are certain times where obviously there's those real golden opportunities.
Those were good examples.
Good, okay. Are there any particular ways that you think we're well positioned in primary care to reduce these health inequalities?
Thinking about knowledge and understanding of your practice population is a really good starting point. It's something public health can help with. We do have things like needs assessments and data available. But also GPs and clinicians will have real insight into their population as a whole. You can make sure that you're really understanding what the specific needs and characteristics of your population are, and that can help you then in individual interactions with patients as well.
Brilliant. And from my experiences working in other countries where there's a lot of higher levels of need and that health inequalities is really at the forefront of my mind, education is the theme that I kept coming back to, of actually you need to educate the family, you need to educate the patient on how to manage their acute and their chronic health conditions, and that is one of the key things that makes a really big difference.
Yeah, I think in terms of education, I agree. I think it can be really helpful to help families understand and manage the health conditions they might have. In doing that, we need to think about the language we use, both in terms of translated material, thinking about literacy. Do we need to provide materials in non-written form, for example, words that might carry certain stigma, so mental health being one of those. That is really helpful, that education piece for families.
I certainly used to draw a lot of pictures when I was working in the developing world for exactly that reason.
Yeah, I think there's something about checking in with what's understood as well, isn't there? It can be quite an information overwhelm.
And again, the cultural aspect coming in there, because in some cultures, they say what they think you want them to say, which would be, yes, I understand.
Yeah.
Whereas actually, if you've not checked in properly, you don't really know how much has gone in and where they are with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what would be your key take-home messages or action plans that you'd like primary care clinicians to take on board?
Just saying that preventing inequalities in children and young people isn't something any single organisation or profession can do. It really has to be done collaboratively or it just won't work. I think we really are greater than the sum of our parts. GPs are critical to that, but not expecting them to be able to manage that on their own. It's easy to say, oh, we need to work better together on this, but it's actually quite complex in practice and there's some real resource challenges across the system. I'd say it's a work in progress, and my ask would be that primary care clinicians work with us through their primary care networks to help us develop ways of working to better support children. My top tips would be understanding your children and young people practice population. As I said, public health can help with the basic demographics, but also thinking about ways to capture and act on your own sort of soft intelligence about your population and understand the unique cultures, risks, vulnerabilities. just that focus that inequalities develop and indeed widen over the life course, so from conception onwards. And so the earlier in a child's life we can act to change the trajectory, the better. That principle of don't wait for problems to escalate, put people in touch with services as early as you can, even thinking about that conception period as part of the child's life. Linking into that wider system to offer early help, there's loads available. Appreciate it's not always easy to understand and access that, but to feed that back to us, if you're finding it hard, we can work to develop ways to make it easier to understand what's out there. We know that early help is better for patient outcomes, but it's also better and more cost effective for the system. So the more we can intervene early, the better. I'd say, and I'm sure GPs do this, but use professional curiosity to understand the patient lives in a really holistic way. Ask questions, try and understand the issues that are really underlying the health thing that they've come into you with, and seeing if we can get to the bottom of the causes, I suppose.
Yes.
And try and address those. And in particular, I really love the Carl Jung quote, know all the theories, master all the techniques, but as you touch a human soul, be just another human soul. I think that's a brilliant concept for anyone working in health or care. And I think it's what GPs are in a position to do and do so well. So recognising the patient as a person with a really complex life within a family, within a community, and thinking about ways they can be supported in a really holistic way.
That's a beautiful quote. I love that.
Yeah, it's great, yeah. Isn't it?
Fantastic. I think a couple of the take-homes for me is that one-stop shop for financial support. I'll definitely be finding the links for those locally and using them more with families. I talk about Citizens Advice Bureau, but it's good to know that there's something a little bit more specific to each individual area. And thinking about the demographic specifically of the children and young people in a particular area and what their needs are and how we can focus on those. And using Serona Wellbeing Leads to help with that, as well as your needs assessment reports and public health. I think that's a really good take-home message today. So brilliant. Thank you very much. Great. Where can interested primary care clinicians find out more about children and young people health inequalities and what they can be doing to support in primary care?
So I can provide links to the resources I've talked about during this session. And also what we're doing at the moment was doing a piece of work looking at Remedy and what's on there. So feedback to us if it's not right, if what's on there isn't helpful.
Brilliant. Well, I'll be looking out for that page.
Great.
Fantastic. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
The contents of these podcasts are for educational purposes, aimed at primary care healthcare professionals only. They do not substitute professional medical advice or consultations with healthcare professionals. Information presented is the opinion of the healthcare professional interviewed, based on their interpretation of best practice and guidelines at the time of the interview. It is the listener's responsibility to compare information given with up-to-date national and local guidelines. The BNSSG Training Hub, Ruth Bowen and interviewees are not liable for any clinical decisions made as a result of this podcast.